This morning we will continue our sermon series in the book of Joshua, and again we are pressing on through everyone's favorite portion of Joshua, where most of you, I'm sure, have much of this memorized, but continuing in the inheritance of the places in Joshua 14 through 15. We will start by reading just Joshua 14. We'll read Joshua 15 a little bit later in the service. But this is God's breathed out, inspired word, profitable for righteousness. Hear now the word of the Lord from Joshua chapter 14. And by the way, this is not on page Roman numeral 30, but 189 in your pew Bibles. So 189 in your pew Bibles, Joshua 14. Hear the word of the Lord. These are the inheritances that the people of Israel received in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel gave them to inherit. Their inheritance was by lot, just as the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses for the 9 1/2 tribes. For Moses had given an inheritance to the 2 1/2 tribes beyond the Jordan, but to the Levites he gave no inheritance among them. For the people of Joseph were 2 tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and no portion was given to the Levites in the land, but only cities to dwell in, with their pasture lands for their livestock and their substance. The people of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses. They allotted the land. Then the people of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought him word again as it was in my heart. But my brothers who went up with me made the heart of the people melt. Yet I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses swore on that day, saying, 'Surely the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God.' And now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, just as he said, these 45 years since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I am this day 85 years old. I am still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said." Then Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb the son of Jephunneh for an inheritance. Therefore Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord, the God of Israel. Now the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriath Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim, and the land had rest from war. One of my somber but most important responsibilities as a pastor is to remind you in no uncertain terms that the day is coming when all of us will die. The day is coming when you will die. This is not a pleasant thing. This is not positive and encouraging, but it is reality. And actually, there have been a lot of, even this past week, a lot of events that have even particularly reminded me of that. We're in a stage when our congregation, when several people in our congregation are mourning the loss of parents and grandparents, people whom we have loved for years and years and years and decades, who suddenly are not with us anymore. More than that, my wife actually came across one of the more horrific reminders of this when she came right on the scene of an accident as we were traveling back to Lincoln in separate vehicles, where she came on the scene of an accident where a 67-year-old woman had stopped her car on the side of the road and walked directly into traffic. It was a terrible, horrible thing. This is reality. This is the world we live in. It was also the case on Monday morning when our son at 2:30 in the morning, Caleb, 3 months old, woke up hyperventilating and struggling to breathe. And he had croup, where his little trachea swelled up to the point that he couldn't breathe enough. And so we learned where all of the hospitals in Omaha are. Thankfully, he's doing much better today. All of these are reminders. We aren't guaranteed another day. We aren't guaranteed another hour. We aren't guaranteed a thing. We aren't even guaranteed when we put our families and our children to bed that they will wake up the next morning. This is a sobering reality. And it makes us ask the question, what is life for? What are we doing here? How then ought we to live? Should we eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die? Should we try to numb ourselves to the pain and suffering and death around us through alcohol or drugs or through throwing ourselves into our work to numb and make us forget about everything around us? Well, one of the most helpful things in life to give us perspective, to give us insight and wisdom for the journey ahead of us, is to look at some of the seasoned saints who have lived long and faithfully on this earth. And as we come to the story of Caleb, that's exactly what we find here. A man who has lived faithfully 85 years and is now finally, at the very end of his life, entering into the promise for which he has hoped all these years to receive his inheritance. We don't know much about Caleb, certainly not as much as Joshua, or definitely not as much as Moses before him. But the few things we do know about Caleb give us a pattern, a track record, a trajectory to life, to see exactly from Caleb how we ought to live in light of the sufferings of this present age. We're going to look at three things today. First of all, the basis for Caleb's confidence. Second, the reason for Caleb's motivation in getting through all these long years. And finally, the scope and the range of what he particularly finds valuable. As we look at the story of Caleb, the first thing that we are confronted with his life and influence and his example, is that our record, our achievements and accomplishments and the things that we do, these are not the basis for our confidence. All that you achieve, even your faith, the strength of your faith, that is not the basis for your confidence. Now, let's look at the life of Caleb. Let me back up and we'll kind of work our way into this. We see this story of Caleb moving forward. The first part of chapter 14, the first five verses, describe sort of the transition from the inheritance that the two and one half of the tribes receive on the east of the Jordan River. This is the land that Moses had conquered and that Moses had assigned to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And now the rest of the tribes are going to receive their inheritance in the land. And so now, right now in the book of Joshua, we're shifting from talking about the inheritance on the east of the Jordan to talking about the inheritance in the land of Canaan proper, west of the Jordan, the land that we typically think of as the land of Israel. So as we come here, the first of the people to receive their inheritance is Caleb. And there's a reason for that, because Caleb is one of the oldest surviving Israelites at this point in time. Because of the fact that 45 years earlier, and he tells us this, he was one of the 12 spies that Moses had selected to send into the land of Canaan. So this is actually probably about 38 years ago. 38 years ago, this is 45 years ago, but 2 years into the wilderness wanderings, 38 years before they actually started the conquest into the land of Canaan, Moses sends Caleb, along with Joshua and 10 other spies, to spy out the land. And this is in, you can find this story in Numbers chapter 13 and Numbers chapter 14, but Caleb and Joshua alone come back with a good report about the land. This is a wonderful land. God will give us this land. Let us go into the land and take our inheritance right now. But the other 10 spies cause the heart of the people to melt. That's what Caleb relates in Joshua 14, verse 8, about what happened 45 years before. They say, there are giants in the land. We seem to be like grasshoppers before them. They will devour us and our children. It would have been better for us to die in Egypt. It would be better for us to die here in the promised land than to try to go in to the land of Canaan. And they actually try to appoint a leader to lead them back to the land of Egypt, which is foolishness. But God stops them and says, well, if you think it would be preferable for you to die in the land of the wilderness, then that will be what your lot is. For 40 years you will wander in the wilderness until every last one of you who came out from the land of Egypt, who saw all my signs and wonders, dies. Except for Caleb and Joshua, who believed that God could bring them into the land of Canaan, into their inheritance. And right now, 45 years later, this means that the probably been about 7 years that they've been fighting in the promised land. Finally, Caleb is ready to receive his inheritance. He says, this is what was promised to me. We've come to the time where the inheritance is being doled out. Let's go. I want to receive this for which I have waited these last 45 years. So Caleb has a long track record of faith. But also for these last 7 years, we're not told directly that Caleb participated in the fighting, but that's everywhere implied, especially when he says in verse 11 that his strength is now as his strength was then, 45 years ago, for war and for going and for coming. It's unlikely that he would know whether his body is fit for war if he hadn't actually been fighting. It's sort of like when you think you can play a pickup basketball game. Maybe this doesn't apply to anyone but me. And then you start running one lap up the court and you think, wow, I am horrifically out of shape. And you just want to sort of like lean over and die. Unless you've been fighting, you don't know if your body is in that kind of condition. But Caleb does. So long time ago, he's exhibited faith and followed the Lord. Let's go, let's take the land. These last 7 years, he's put his life where his mouth is, risked himself to go into the fighting, to receive the inheritance. And then finally in verse 12, he says, I'm not going to stop. He says in verse 12, so now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me as I move forward from here. And I shall drive them out just as the Lord says. He's still on the mission. He's still pursuing what God had called them to do. He's saying, I'm not going to stop now. I'm entering into my inheritance so I can finish what God has called us to do. So this is a man that at every stage of his life, all the places that we find out information about him, he has been obediently obeying the mission of the Lord, obediently living by faith. If anyone could boast a record, it was Caleb. Caleb can say, look at my long track record. But is that what he's doing here? Is he saying, look, I've paid my dues, I've put in my time. It's time for me to get what's mine. Well, no, not exactly. Look back at what Caleb says here. Look at verse 6. Caleb approaches Joshua and says, you know what the Lord, and again, Lord, all capital letters, that's Yahweh. You know what Yahweh said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea, concerning you and me. This whole speech starts off with the promises of God. You know the promises. I am here not because I am worthy, not because I have established a track record. I'm here because of what Yahweh swore to us 45 years ago. I'm here to receive the promises of God. But then keep looking through the page. Look over to verse 10. And now, behold, the Lord, Yahweh, has kept me alive. Just as he said, these 45 years since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel walked in the wilderness. In other words, he's been keeping his promises for 45 years. God is faithful. I have every reason to believe that he's going to give me the inheritance he promised me because he actually preserved me. He made promises to me. He preserved me for 45 years. I have every reason to believe he's going to be faithful. It's time to receive the inheritance. And then finally, look at verse 12. Again, that second part of the sentence. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said. Here's the thing. Caleb is saying, I'm totally given over to the Lord's purposes. If the Lord wants to take me home, if he doesn't want to be with me in this fight, that is my place. But until then, until that day, I am going to continue after the mission that God has given his people to possess fully the land of Canaan, driving out all the inhabitants of the land. Everywhere you look in this speech, Caleb is pointing to Yahweh. He's not pointing to his records, the things he has done. He is not pointing to the strength of his faith. Aren't I a wonderful example to all of you in the way that I have believed? He is saying, don't look at me. Look at what Yahweh has spoken. Look at what Yahweh has done. Look at what Yahweh will do for me. His confidence is not in himself or his faith as much as it is in the object of his faith, the Lord. In our world, it's very common to talk about doing what you believe or being sincere in what you believe or trying to live consistently with your beliefs. And we have these sort of vague, warm, fuzzy ideas about faith. But the biblical notion of faith is something that's different from that. The Bible insists that faith is critical. It is the only means by which we can be saved. But the reason it says that is because the Bible doesn't put the emphasis on faith so much as the object of our faith. The only reason that faith works in Christianity is because it lays hold of something outside of us that has actually accomplished salvation for us, namely Jesus Christ. The gospel of Christianity is not that we can believe better and overcome all the highest mountains, or that we can do more and become better people. The gospel is that we can do nothing, that we have failed at all things, but that Jesus Christ succeeded in every respect, that he himself was a perfect man who lived the perfect life, upholding all of the law, and that he went to the cross to suffer in our place for everywhere that we have failed. And that because of that, he is competent, he is able, he is mighty and righteous to save. Our faith then, Caleb's faith, looked to Yahweh, to Jesus Christ, as the reason for his confidence. Now this helps us for two reasons. Because Satan attacks us on different sides. One of those sides is to get us to believe that our hope, our confidence, our certainty that we stand to inherit something is based off of how well we are performing, how many things we are doing, how strongly our faith is being exercised. And either we will be encouraged in pride or discouraged in shame as we start looking to our own record. But the gospel says, don't look to yourself. Robert Murray McShane once said, for every one look at yourself you take, take 10 looks at Christ. Keep going to him. Keep looking to him. When you fail, look to him. When you succeed, give him the glory. But the other way that Satan attacks us is by causing us to lose sight of the confidence that we have. That actually everything we are doing in this life is really genuinely going somewhere. You see, very often we get caught up in our little worlds and our little lives and our little parochial private interests, and we start looking at this very, very small range of vision, and we forget that God is pleased to cause us to inherit the kingdom. We forget that God has begun the work of new creation already in our lives through Christ, and we stop looking to the future, to the streets of gold that stand just out of our reach, as we sang about a little bit earlier. You and I are called to something better than this life, bigger than this life, beyond this life. But in this life, we are given a hope and a confidence through the object of our faith, Jesus Christ. Your record is not the basis for your confidence. But the next question we might want to ask is, well, why did Caleb do all of this? And for that, as we start to really dive in, let's look at Joshua chapter 15. Now there are, I will say, 63 verses in this chapter, but just to warn you, many of these verses are only a handful of words. They're going to be fun to pronounce words, but just buckle in. There's some really good stuff here. This is the word of the Lord. So let's read together Joshua 15. The allotment for the tribe of the people of Judah, according to their clans, reached southward to the boundary of Edom, to the wilderness of Zin in the farthest south. And their south boundary ran from the end of the Salt Sea, from the bay that faces southward. It goes southward of the ascent of Akrabim, passes along to Zin, and goes up south of Kanesh Barnea, along by Hezron, up to Adar, turns about to Karka, passes along to Asmon, goes out by the brook of Egypt, and comes to its end at the sea. This shall be your south boundary, just so everyone's kind of clear where that south boundary is. And the east boundary is the Salt Sea to the mouth of the Jordan. And the boundary of the north side runs from the Bay of the Sea at the mouth of the Jordan. And the boundary goes up to Beth Hogla and passes along north of Beth Araba. And the boundary goes up to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben. And the boundary goes up to Debir from the valley of Achor, and so northward, turning toward Gilgal, which is opposite the ascent of Adumim, which is on the south side of the valley. And the boundary passes along the waters of En Shemesh and ends at En Rogel. And the boundary goes up by the valley of the son of Hinnom at the southern shoulder of the Jebusite, that is Jerusalem. And the boundary goes up to the top of the mountain that lies over against the valley of Hinnom on the west, at the northern end of the valley of Rephaim. Then the boundary extends from the top of the mountain to the spring of the waters of Nephtoah, and from there to the cities of Mount Ephron. Then the boundary bends toward Baalah, that is Kiriath Yearim, and the boundary circles west of Baalah to Mount Seir, passes along to the northern shoulder of Mount Jearim, that is Kesalon, and goes down to Beth Shemesh and passes along by Timnah. The boundary goes out to the shoulder of the hill north of Ekron. Then the boundary bends around to Shikaron and passes along to Mount Baalah and goes to Jabneel. Then the boundary comes to the end of the sea, and the west boundary was the great sea with its coastline. This is the boundary around the people of Judah according to their clans. Okay, everyone catch a breath. We have some narrative here for a little bit. According to the commandment of the Lord to Joshua, he gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the people of Judah. Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. Arba was the father of Anak. And Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak. And he went up from there against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "Whoever strikes Kiriath Sefer and captures it, to him will I give Aksah, my daughter, as wife." And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it. And he gave him Aksah, his daughter, as wife. When she came to him, she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she got off her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me the land of the Negev, give me also the springs of water." And he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the people of Judah, according to their clans. The cities belonging to the tribe of the people of Judah in the extreme south toward the boundary of Edom were Kabzeel, Eder, Yagur, Kina, Demona, Adada, Kedesh, Hazor, Ithnan, Ziph, Telem, Baaloth, Hazor, Hadata, Kiriath Hezron, that is Hazor, Amam, Shema, Molada, Hazar Gada, Heshmon, Beth Pelet, Hazar Shual, Beersheba, Biziothia, Baala, Eam, Ezim, Eltadad, Kesil, Horma, Ziklag, Madanma. Anyway, should we read this together? Sansana, Lebaoth, Shilhim, Ain, and Rimmon, in all 29 cities with their villages. This should be a responsive reading. And in the lowland, Eshtaol, Zora, Ashna, Zanoa, Enganim, Tapua, Enam, Jarmuth, Adulam, Soko, Azekah, Sha'arim, Adithaim, Gedera, Gederathaim, 14 cities with their villages. Zinan, Hadasha, Migaldad, Dilayan, Mizped, Jokthiel, Lashish, Bozkath, Eglon, Kaban, Lahman, Chitlish, Gederoth, Beth Dagon, Naama, and Makeda, 16 cities with their villages. Libna, Ether, Ashan, Iftha, Ashna, Neziv, Kela, Azkib, Marasha, 9 cities with their villages, almost their people. Ekron with its towns and its villages, from Ekron to the sea, all that were by the side of Ashdod with their villages. Ashdod, its towns and its villages. Gaza, its town and its villages, to the brook of Egypt and the great sea with its coastline. And in the hill country, Shamir, Jatir, Soko, Dana, Kiriath Sana, that is Debir, Anab, Eshtemoth, Anim, Goshen, Holon, and Gilo, 11 cities with their villages. Arab, Duma, Eshan, Janim, Beth Tapua, Afekah, Humta, Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, and Zior, 9 cities with their villages. Maon, Carmel, Ziph, Juta, Jezreel, Jokdeam, Zanoa, Kain, Gibeah, and Timnah, 10 cities with their villages. Halhul, Bethzur, Gedor, Ma'arath, Beth Anoth, and Elkatan, 6 cities with their villages. Kiriath Baal, that is Kiriath Jearim, and Rabbah, 2 cities with their villages. Almost there. In the wilderness, Beth Araba, Midden, Sekaka, Nibshan, the city of salt, and En Gedi, six cities with their villages. But the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of Judah could not drive out. So the Jebusites dwell with the people of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. By the way, we read these because we believe that the Bible is inspired. And even though we won't go town by town, this is meant to be read. So thank you for your patience as we at least read it in our hearing. So, our record is not the basis of our confidence. But what we also discover in this, as we look back at 13 verse to verse 19, our reward is not the reason for our motivation. So maybe you have heard of the lottery test. If you won the lottery today, which maybe you think by hearing all of those towns, you did in a sense, right? Okay, but if you actually won the lottery with all kinds of money, and you had enough money to live for the rest of your life without ever working another day in your life, would you go back to your job tomorrow morning at 8, or some of you I know get to work by 5, whatever time, or would you be back in the office tomorrow? Okay, I hear a no. That's fine. What that means is that we have external motivators that cause us to work, right? We would like to feed our families and keep a roof over our heads and things like that. And sometimes we're in work that, if that's the main reason that you are there, that is good and right and noble to persist there. But there are other reasons to do work in life. If any of you were able to answer yes, yes, I would be back at work, that means that you have internal motivation. You are not doing your work just for the money. You are not doing it just to fill up the rest of your pension or to become fully vested in your stock options or whatever it is that your compensation package is. You are doing it because you believe in the work. Now, as it happens, we are able to give a lottery test to Caleb, even if he wouldn't know what a lottery was. But in fact, here in this story, he did win the lottery. He got his inheritance. He cashed out. He got everything he would need to live for the rest of his life. And what a lot of the people of Israel were doing as they received their inheritance and as Israel was at a prime place of strength is they were not completing the mission as God had told them to by driving the remaining inhabitants out of the land. They were taking those people and making them to do forced labor, which increased their wealth, but it wasn't what God told them to do. So in Joshua chapter 13, verse 13, we read that the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacath dwell in the midst of Israel to this day. And in Joshua 16, verse 10, as we'll look at a little bit next week, however, they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites have lived in the midst of Ephraim to this day, but have been made to do forced labor. Then in Joshua 17, verse 13, now when the people of Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. And then if you peek all the way over to the book of Judges, in Judges chapter 1, verses 27 through 33, again and again we read that each tribe failed to drive out the Canaanites. But not Caleb. Caleb does what God says to do. Why? Because he wasn't just looking to get his golden watch and retire into luxury for the rest of his retirement. He believed in the mission. He believed God when God told him, and look in Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 18, and Deuteronomy 20, among many other passages, that if they allowed the Canaanites to remain in the land, then very soon those Canaanites would drag them away to worship their false gods, to do all kinds of detestable sexual practices, and even to sacrifice their own children to their demon gods. It would have been a horrific thing, and God said, "Don't do that. Drive the inhabitants out of the land." And because Caleb believed in that, we see that he drove out the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak. What Caleb understood was that his inheritance, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, his inheritance was not the end in itself. Wealth is not the end in itself. His inheritance was for a purpose, which was that so there God could dwell with his people in their midst, and God could be their God, and he would take them to be his people. The land they had was to be the place where God dwelt with them. And so when Caleb received his retirement payout, He took it and said, let's continue the mission. So what that means is that Caleb was thinking longer term than his lifetime. So the first thing we have seen is that our record, Caleb didn't plead his record, neither should we. Our record is not the basis for our confidence. Our reward is not the reason for our motivation. But the other thing we see, like Caleb, our lifetime should not be the scope of what we value. Here's what I mean. Caleb actually here not only cares about the future of his people, which is why he drives out the Canaanites, but notice that he also recruits new leaders and trains them, gives them experiences so that they're not depending on the faith of people like Caleb and Joshua, but they're actually getting experiences trusting the Lord. So he says, okay, someone else, go strike Kiriath Sefer and capture it. To whoever does this, I'll give Aksa, my daughter, as wife. And so we read in verse 17 that Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it. Well, first of all, in case you're wondering, the law did not prohibit marrying a half-blooded niece, which is probably what is here because Caleb is the son of Jephunneh, but Othniel is the son of Kenaz. But brother may be actually more like a cousin or something like that. But Othniel actually comes up again in Judges chapter 3. He becomes one of the early leaders in the nation of Israel after the days of Joshua as a judge. So right now we see Caleb kind of training the next generation up to continue the mission in the land of Canaan. But if you tease this out, understand what's happening. None of the other tribes of Israel drive out the remaining vestiges of Canaanites from the land. Here's why this is so important, and we're wrapping up here. Here's why this is so important. Because Caleb was a representative of Judah, and Caleb drove out most of the Canaanites from the land of Judah. Well, if you know where this story goes deeper into Israel's history, you know that eventually, the people of Judah, the tribe of Judah, would separate from the other 10 tribes. Benjamin would also go with Judah. But Judah was more godly and lasted longer. It had some wicked kings, so they eventually went into exile in Babylon in 586 or 87 BC. But Israel, the northern nations where the Canaanites were not driven out, disappeared 150 years earlier, about, in 722 BC by the Assyrians. Why? Because Israel was completely corrupt. They never had a single godly king. Why? Humanly speaking, because only Caleb drove out the remaining inhabitants from the land. This was hundreds of years after the death of Caleb, and his work was still making a lasting influence in the coming generations. But from the tribe of Judah, there's also a hint here. Verse 63, the only thing that the Judahites were not able to do was to drive out the inhabitants of Jerusalem in verse 63. And this says that they could not drive, not that they did not. So they tried, it seems, but weren't able to do it. They needed a greater deliverer. And the greater deliverer came only a few hundred years later in the person of David, a king from the tribe of Judah, who in 2 Samuel chapter 5 drives out the Jebusites and claims Jerusalem for the city of God. But even David wasn't able to do everything. Where the story is really headed, where we see the inheritance of the first tribe of God's people, Judah, is that this is paving the way all the way to the greater son of David, to the greater Judahite, to Jesus Christ himself, who is coming to give us an inheritance. An inheritance which is completely pure, completely undefiled, where no corruption can enter into it, a new Jerusalem. That we are waiting for one day on the last day when God's inheritance comes down from heaven to bring a new earth, a new heavens into creation as God restores all of it for us to dwell in. Why? So that God will dwell with us to be our God, and so that we will be his people, and so that God will wipe away every tear from our eyes. This is where all of this tracks toward. This is why it's worthwhile to read so many obscure cities. Because through this, God is pointing us toward the greater inheritance that we have in Christ. This is why it is worth living. And this is how we ought to live in light of this present age. Trusting and believing Jesus, recognizing that what we do is not the basis for our acceptance before God. Jesus and his righteousness is. Trusting that it's not about getting stuff, but it's about getting God himself. And awaiting the day, maybe many, many, many generations beyond our own lifetime, when God brings all of this to fulfillment. Pray with me. Father, we pray that you would make us faithful for the long haul. God, we ask us that every step we take would be taken with faith in the Lord Jesus, in his righteousness instead of our own, for the sake that one day we will be with Jesus. We lift this prayer request up to you, according to the promises that you have made in your word, for the sake and glory of your own Son. It's in his name we pray. Amen.